Good afternoon. It is Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. Thanks so much for joining us. Save the Chimps made headlines when it rescued Terry the chimpanzee in October 2013 from the scandal-ridden Las Vegas Zoo, where he had lived in solitary confinement for 18 years. Save the Chimps is a 200-acre facility and the largest chimpanzee sanctuary in the world. Today, we visit with the director of the sanctuary, Jen Feierstein. She's also one of the preeminent authorities on chimpanzee welfare. We'll hear about the many changes that occurred in 2013, and we'll discuss the book, Opening Doors, Carol Noon and Her Dream to Save the Chimps by Gary Ferguson. It chronicles one woman's vision and determination to create the sanctuary. Jane Feierstein joins us from Save the Chimps in Fort Pierce, Florida. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
Just to follow up for a second, I talked about Terry that you had rescued. How's Terry doing now?
He's doing really well. We, over the past several months, have introduced him to a few chimps. And because he lived alone for so long, he definitely is a little bit apprehensive when he meets new chimpanzees. So we're taking it very slow. But he's made a really good friend in a chimpanzee named Wally, who, like him, was involved in the entertainment industry, and he's also friends with a female named Pam. So we're hoping that his circle of friends will slowly grow over the next several months.
Oh, that's good. Well, I'd like to begin with a little history of Save the Chimps by Carol Noon. How did it get started? Can you give us a thumbnail of that?
Sure. Dr. Noon had worked with chimpanzees in different settings, most notably at a sanctuary in Africa called Chimfunchi. And she really had a dream to establish a similar sanctuary in the United States. Their chimps are used in research and the entertainment industry and the pet trade, and there was an increasing number of chimpanzees who were in need. She saw a great opportunity when the Air Force decided to get out of the chimpanzee research business. And there was an opportunity to rescue about 140 chimpanzees from the Air Force. So she actually put in a bid to take all of those chimpanzees and ultimately got custody of 21 of those chimps. And that's what started it all. And not long after the Air Force chimps arrived, a big laboratory in New Mexico closed down and 266 chimpanzees were rescued at one time. So most of our residents come from there.
That was the Colston Foundation?
That was the Colston Foundation, yes.
And of the 140 that you said were rescued from the Air Force that they were using, you said how many were rescued?
Well, Dr. Noon actually ended up having to sue the Air Force because they rejected her bid out of hand. And ultimately, they settled out of court, and they agreed to send her 21 chimps. 30 chimps went to a place in Texas called Primarily Primates, and 111 had gone to the Colston Foundation. So out of those 111, she got 21 of those chimpanzees. Those were the first residents of Save the Chimps.
Now, are there still chimpanzees in New Mexico?
There are. There are chimpanzees living on Holloman Air Force Base in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Those chimpanzees are owned by the NIH, by the federal government.
You mean for research?
Yes. They were used in research.
Hmm. What has happened to that movement to get them removed from being used for biomedical research?
There have been really a lot of great steps forward over the past year or two. Last year, the NIH announced that they would be significantly reducing both the funding for and the use of chimpanzees in research, and that they would be retiring about 300 or so chimpanzees owned by the federal government who've been used in biomedical research. So since that time, they haven't actually retired any yet, but it was definitely a big announcement, and we're definitely anticipating that there will be many chimps coming out of research in the coming years, which is great news for the chimpanzees.
Yeah. And tell us a little about how Save the Chimps actually functions. How do you get them? I mean, you've told us how you get the ones you've told us about. And medical care, and how many chimps can you accommodate? How long do they live? Stuff like that.
Well, we have right now, we have 260 residents. Over the past several years. Since our first chimps arrived in 2001, we've rescued about 325 chimps. But of course, as the chimpanzees age, they do pass away. Chimps usually live to be in their 40s, but they sometimes can live to be in their 50s or even their 60s. And the way we get chimps are people voluntarily turning them over to us. We don't have any authority to confiscate chimps. We don't, you know, go into facilities and take chimps against people's will. It's always people contacting us. If they have a chimpanzee, whether it's a pet, a chimpanzee who's being retired from research or the entertainment industry, they contact us. And if we have the capacity, we do accept chimpanzees. We have an acceptance policy that has to be abided by, but we try to accommodate as many of the requests as we can.
Now, you say you don't have the authority to confiscate chimpanzees, but what if somebody knows of a chimp in an abusive situation, be it the entertainment industry or a pet or whatever? Is there anything people can do?
Yes, if people know of a chimpanzee who's living in a situation that they believe to be inappropriate or harmful to that chimpanzee, they can contact the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA. The USDA oversees the conditions that captive species, most captive species, live in. And so they would be the government authority to contact. In the state of Florida, chimpanzees are also regulated and overseen by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. So people can also contact the FWC if they have any concerns about a chimpanzee or any other exotic animal
that they believe to be in a harmful situation.
Yes.
How is Save the Chimps funded? Just by private donations?
Yes, we are entirely 100% funded by private donations. At this time, we don't get any government funding, so we rely on the generosity of compassionate individuals who care about chimpanzees and care about what's happened to these chimps in their past and want to give them a good retirement. We are very generously supported by a foundation called the Arcus Foundation. The founder of the Arcus Foundation, John Stryker, also helped to establish Save the Chimps. He partnered with Carol and was instrumental in making Save the Chimps what it is today. But we also rely just on the kindness and generosity of individuals, family foundations, and other private entities.
And I just want to say here that we'll have a link. Your website is savethechimps.org.
Yes, that's correct. And we just relaunched our website, and it's beautiful. I think we'll really enjoy it.
It is very beautiful. And so is this book, Opening Doors, Carol Noon and Her Dream to Save the Chimps. Now, who is Gary Ferguson?
Gary Ferguson was an author who came to us via someone that John Stryker knew. And he had written books about wild animals in the past, particularly wolves. And he came out to the sanctuary and began to interview people about Carol, went through some of her writings, her letters, and what she called her chimp diaries. And he did an incredible job of capturing her personality and her voice without ever having met her. I was very moved by what he wrote and thought he did an incredible job.
How did Carol Noon, Dr. Carol Noon, develop this passion to save the chimps?
Well, like many people who work with chimpanzees, she was inspired by Dr. Jane Goodall, who was one of the pioneers who studied chimpanzees in the wild starting in the 1960s. And she now travels the world almost 300 days a year telling people about chimpanzees and asking for better treatment, not only of chimps, but just the planet in general. So Dr. Noon saw Jane Goodall speak at a university, and she was inspired by what she had to say, and she was fascinated by the chimpanzees. And so she just began taking every opportunity she could to observe and learn about chimpanzees.
I want to just mention, we're speaking with Jane Firestein. She's the director of Save the Chimp Sanctuary. It's in Fort Pierce, Florida, right in our backyard, really. And it's the largest in the world. And Jen Firestein will be presenting and signing this book that we're discussing, Opening Doors, Carol Noon and Her Dream to Save the Chimps, at the Vero Beach Book Center. It's this Saturday, April 26th at 3 p.m. And we'll also have a link if you'd like to go or interested. It's verobeachbookcenter.com. That's their website if you want to see more and see about this speaking engagement. And we will have a link to that on our website. So we're going to talk more about chimpanzees with Jen Firestein after a short break on Topical Currents. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us. It's Topical Currents for Thursday. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Jane Firestein, the director of Save the Chimp Sanctuary in Fort Pierce, Florida. And if you have a question, the number is 1-800-743-9576. A question for Jen, 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@wlrn.org. So, Jen, I'd like to talk about, like, the medical needs. Do you have vets on staff? And is that how you minister to their medical needs?
Yes, we do have two full-time veterinarians. Our senior veterinarian, Dr. Jocelyn Besner, has been with us since 2003, and she's an incredible chimpanzee veterinarian. And the chimpanzees face really a wide variety of medical issues and have many different medical needs. Heart disease, unfortunately, is quite common in captive great apes, chimpanzees, as well as gorillas and orangutans. And so she actually consults with cardiologists and other specialists to ensure that we are giving proper medical care for heart disease. And the chimps also will have arthritis. We have a couple of chimps who are diabetic. They also may just get regular colds and flu, and they can also get injuries. Chimpanzees are really powerful. They have really long canine teeth. And although most of the time they get along just fine, every once in a while conflict arises, and so they might get some minor injuries that have to be monitored or treated. So our vets are very, very busy making sure that the chimps get all the medical care that they need.
So they get a lot of illnesses that we get, that humans get. Like,
yeah, they are susceptible. They're susceptible to our upper respiratory diseases, colds and flu. So we, as their caregivers, have to be very careful not to transmit that to them. So we wear gloves when we're serving them their food. We wear face masks, and we do everything that we can to try to avoid transmitting those illnesses to the chimps.
You said sometimes they don't get along. I'm just wondering, have some of these chimps been sort of domesticated? Are there some that are more wild than others, some that are less?
Well, all chimpanzees are wild animals. Some chimpanzees are more comfortable around humans and prefer the company of humans to chimpanzees because of their past history. Mm-hmm. Particularly chimps who were raised as pets, sometimes they don't seem to know that they're chimpanzees. They identify as human beings. They may have, had their own room, watched television, ate pizza, done a lot of very human-oriented activities. But when they grow up, they are so powerful, they have minds of their own, and they can become very, very dangerous. So even if they grow up as human, they don't always act as we would expect human beings to act, and they can really pose a danger. So when we get former pet chimpanzees in particular, we really have to take a lot of time to integrate them into chimpanzee society. And so far we've been quite successful at it, but it takes a lot of patience and a lot of time and a lot of understanding, because these chimps are really caught in the middle of two worlds, and it's not their fault at all.
Right. Do you have any physical contact with them, any interactions with them?
We don't have physical contact in a sense of touching them or going in with them, but we do have plenty of interactions with them. Mm-hmm. Chimpanzees are very vocal. They're very expressive. And so the caregivers know the individual chimps very well. The chimps know their caregivers very well, but it's always done at a safe distance and with a barrier in between between us and the chimps.
We're speaking with Jen Feierstein. She's the director of Save the Chimps Sanctuary in Fort Pierce, Florida. Questions or comments, the number's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. I'm assuming you don't breed the chimps. Do you, is it called spaying and neutering for chimps?
We do not allow the chimps to reproduce, or we do our best to prevent it. Mm-hmm. We have had a couple of accidental births over the years, but the way we practice birth control is the males have gotten vasectomies, and the females are also on birth control pills as a backup. So we found that a lot of the vasectomies that were done several years ago actually grew back. So we have the females on birth control pills as a backup until we're confident that the vasectomies are permanent.
I see. Do chimps establish a pecking order? Are there alpha males or those who are more submissive, or do some try to gain control over the others?
Chimps do have a dominance hierarchy. In the wild, it's typically very clear-cut with an alpha male and then typically, all of the males are dominant over females. In captivity, because these chimps grew up either in isolation or with just a few other chimps, they didn't have the opportunity to really experience a good, firm social organization. So they're trying to figure that out. And so sometimes it means things are pretty fluid. You can have females who are dominant over males. You can have a group where you're not really sure is one particular male, the alpha male, the leader of the group. Other groups, you will have a male or a female who will really rise to the occasion and become a leader. And so it's been very interesting to see the social dynamics develop and change over the years.
Now, is Save the Chimps open to the public?
We are not open to the public. As a sanctuary, we decided that to give the chimps a peaceful retirement, we wouldn't have visitors coming to view them on a daily basis. However, we do have two member days per year, one in January and one in September. And donors at the $50 level and above are invited out to the sanctuary for guided tours so that they can see the good work that their generosity is contributing to. And so people are able to walk around the sanctuary, it's about a mile and a quarter, and view the chimpanzees out on their islands.
We have a question from Carol in Miami regarding funding. Hi, Carol. You're on Topical Currents. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about funding. I did hear earlier that all the funding for Save the Chimps is private funding, and I was curious about, for instance, government funding for facilities like this, because I'm thinking that, you know, if there are agencies or institutions that have utilized these animals in research, would they not somehow be responsible for some kind of maintenance in perpetuity once the animals are retired? Mm. Is there no requirement for that?
Good question. Jen?
That's a great question. There is one piece of federal legislation called the CHIMP Act that was put into place in the year 2000, and that established funding for a chimpanzee sanctuary system. At this time, there's only one sanctuary in the United States, Chimp Haven, who is currently receiving that funding. It's possible in the future that other sanctuaries will become eligible, but we absolutely agree. We do think that the organizations and individuals who have used these chimps should bear responsibility for their long-term care. Unfortunately, that hasn't always been the case. In the case of the Colson Foundation, for example, that laboratory went completely bankrupt and had no funding at all for the chimps' futures. People who surrender them to us as pets, we do ask for some support, and sometimes people do bear responsibility, but most often they can no longer afford to take care of the chimps. And so the burden does end up falling on the sanctuary's shoulders.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling, Carol. What is this proposal by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to remove split listing between captive chimps and those living in the wild? And what is that status?
Yes, chimpanzees have had a very unusual designation when it comes to the Endangered Species Act. So chimpanzees in the wild are considered an endangered species, and they are critically endangered. There may be as few as 150,000 to 300,000 chimpanzees left in the wild. Their population is being depleted by poaching and by habitat loss, and they really are in dire straits. But when a species is designated as endangered, that protects them from harm, in theory. So it would be illegal to experiment on a chimpanzee, for example, to harm them by giving them a disease or doing experimental surgeries. To get around that, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service created this loophole where they said that wild chimpanzees are endangered, but captive chimpanzees are not considered endangered and therefore are not protected by the Endangered Species Act. That's been in place for probably about 20, 25 years now, and in 2010, several animal protection groups petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reconsider this position and to declare all chimpanzees endangered. And last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said, yes, we agree, and we propose to do so. They accepted public comments for a period of time, and now we're simply waiting for them to issue a final decision.
So that is forthcoming, and is that supposed to be sometime soon?
We don't know, or at least I don't know. I have not heard when that decision will be coming. We certainly hope it will be soon, and it will end up offering some additional protections to captive chimpanzees when it comes to their use in research and entertainment in the pet trade.
Right. So that would be a good regulation, obviously, if that were enforced.
Yes, it would be very, very positive. There still would be loopholes, but it would just make it more difficult, and it would further reinforce the direction that we're already going in, which is to reduce the use of chimps in research and entertainment in the pet trade. There's been a major decline in the past decade of the use of chimps in these areas, and this would just simply help continue to propel that along.
At Save the Chimps, do you offer internships, or do you have the place for volunteers? I see you have a wish list on your website, savethechimps.org, but I didn't notice about volunteers.
We do have a wonderful volunteer program. We have, I think right now, at least 70 volunteers who come and donate their time to help prepare meals for the chimps, prepare enrichment for the chimps, and in some cases help clean the chimpanzees' enclosures. So we do have a volunteer program, and folks are welcome to contact Save the Chimps to apply to be a volunteer. In terms of internships, right now we have an externship for veterinary students. Those who are in their third or fourth year of veterinary school are able to come and work directly with our veterinarians for a period of time.
And as far as the wish list goes, how do you, in what form, I mean, do people just come and drop off peanut butter? How is it done?
Most of the time when people donate items on our wish list to us, they have them shipped. So most people actually order from Amazon.com. We do have a wish list on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
And people just order and it gets shipped directly to us. Our volunteers are wonderful about donating in-kind items, and they will bring things to us. And we do occasionally have local people who will physically drop stuff off at the sanctuary. But for the most part, things are shipped to us.
Well, it's been good to talk to you. I'm so happy you could come on the program. It's Jen Feierstein. She's the director of Save the Chimp Sanctuary. They're right in Fort Pierce, Florida, and it is the world's largest chimpanzee sanctuary. We're also discussing her book, Gary Ferguson's book, rather, Opening Doors, Carol Noon and Her Dream to Save the Chimps, which Jen Feierstein will be presenting and signing at the Vero Beach Book Center this coming Saturday, April 26th at 3 p.m., and we'll have links to SaveTheChimps.org and VeroBeachBookCenter.com on our website. And, Jen, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much, and good luck with the chimps.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. I appreciate you having us on the show.
Thank you. We'll have food and dining coming up next. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. And joining us now is chef, author, syndicated columnist, and cordon bleu chef, Linda Gassenheimer.
Did you get it all in? I'm glad.
I got it all in. And our friend, Linda Gassenheimer. So big changes ahead for the food and food section in the Miami Herald, Linda.
Very exciting.
What are we doing today?
Yes. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Nice to see you. Yeah, news from the Miami Herald food section. Evan Benn is taking over the reins after Kathy Martin retired. Now, Evan has returned to Miami from his successful stint as a food critic and beer columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he's here to give us the scoop on his plans for the food section. Evan Benn, congratulations and welcome. Do we have you, Evan?
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. Congratulations and welcome.
Oh, thanks a lot, Linda.
Great to have you with us. And we'd also like to have our listeners with us. Here's your chance to give Evan feedback on what you like in the food section and what you'd love to see more of in the food section. We'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas. Call us 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or email radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org.
And also with us, of course, is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in today's Miami Herald. You could also read Fred's wine column in today's Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I understand Evan is a beer guy, so I'm going to talk to him about beer.
All right. Sounds good to me.
No bubbly today, friend?
Not today. Well, beer is
beer's bubbly.
That's true.
Evan Benn, heading the food section. So what's your vision going forward for the section?
Well, hey, before we get started, I just wanted to say I'm very sorry to hear about the loss of Rich Davis. I just heard about that a few minutes ago and really enjoyed his show and his personality. So that's a shame.
Yeah, thank you so much. He'll be very, very missed.
In terms of the food section, you know, I'm kind of taking a if it's not broke, don't fix it approach with that. We have a wonderful staple of columnists, which I think I have to say with Linda and Fred in the room, right?
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
We really do have some wonderful content, you know, each week and then kind of on a semi-weekly basis in terms of Cook's Corner with Linda Cicero, which was kind of our main feature today. She went back and former food editor and longtime Cook's Corner writer. She went back and looked at some of her 10 all-time favorite recipes.
That was a great column today, Evan. And I happen to remember when she was the food editor at the Herald.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, readers just really respond, Linda, you know, to recipes. They respond, Fred knows, to recommendations. So our columnists do a really good job of kind of sussing out what's good, what's out there, and telling readers how to do it themselves. So I'm not going to change anything there. You know, we have added a beer column to the weekly food section to complement Fred's wine picks. I go in there and pick a craft beer of the week. Craft beer is really huge now in South Florida. Tom Hudson just did a Sunshine Economy piece on it. And I'm also kind of hoping to look at more, you know, cookbooks and kind of promote them and show what's out there and maybe take a recipe or two from them. But, you know, yeah.
Sounds great. Well, you know, we want our listeners to call in. They may have some ideas for you.
Yeah, I'm all ears.
Yeah, okay, great. Bonnie, do we have an email?
Well, we do. Catherine would like you to please feature more whole grain recipes.
Yeah, we have heard a lot about, you know, healthier recipes, whole grain recipes, diabetes-friendly recipes, you know, gluten-free-friendly recipes. So I will take that to heart. Thank you.
Well, that's interesting, Evan, that, you know, several years ago, I think people don't realize that my Dinner in Minutes column has always fit the government guidelines for nutrition. Never said that because health wasn't sort of in, but I think it's in now. Don't you think so?
I do, and I think it's always in, but whether it's in vogue, whether people know that it's in, you know, whether it's really on the front pages like it has been with the gluten-free fad or with, I won't call it a fad, but you know.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's definitely more on the forefront of people's minds, and they are paying attention to labels and ingredients, and that translates to healthier food, healthier cooking.
Evan, are you going to write the beer column?
I am. I'm going to keep writing the beer column, and you know, I'm a writer at heart. So one thing I hope to bring to the section is more, you know, more local profile cover stories that I will write. You know, and then we don't have to rely as much on, you know, wire stories that might not shine spotlight so much on what's going on here in South Florida. Mm.
That's great.
Evan,
yes.
I understand that even now that you're the food editor, you're still writing other things like the coming of the new publisher at the Herald. Are they working you pretty hard over there?
Well, for the past several months before I took over the food position, I was the economy beat reporter. So I was on the business desk, and I still have a foot tethered to that until they find a replacement for me. So right now I'm kind of pulling double duty. Which is nothing.
80-hour weeks, huh?
It's nothing new at newspapers in this day and age, right?
That's
right,
for sure.
Right. Well, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. It's your chance to talk to the Miami Herald food editor, Evan Benn. Evan, social media, it's so big and all. Tell us, are you going to be doing things with that? What's going on with it?
Yes, absolutely. Social media is huge. It's a huge part of the way people communicate about food these days, whether they take a picture of the turkey sandwich they had for lunch and post it on Instagram, or they're tweeting to a chef about a good or bad experience they had at their restaurant. So we definitely want to get in on that, and I think there's a big opportunity for us to kind of jump into that realm. There are a lot of food blogs and websites in South Florida that do a really great job of kind of telling you what news is going on, what chefs are opening, what restaurants. And the fact of the matter is, we have that content, too, at our sister site, Miami.com. Leslie Abravanel is really the queen of South Florida gossip, but also in terms of she knows what chefs are doing what, who's unveiling what new menu, who's feuding with whom, who's opening, who's closing. So,
yeah, right, absolutely.
So I'm really trying to do a better job of promoting her content there at Miami.com/restaurants. And one way we're doing that is I just created a Twitter account at Miami Herald Food, and that's just one way that we're kind of getting out everything that we do, both in print and also online. So the things that appear in Thursday's paper, I'm going to tweet out and give people links to, and then the things that are kind of online-only content, those little gossipy nibbles and bits, I'm going to give people a chance to see those as well.
Well, that's terrific. And Leslie's amazing. I always say to her, Leslie, how do you know everything and get around to everything that's going on? She said,
I mean, even things that I find out, I think I find out first. She found out about it yesterday. So
yeah, she's absolutely.
Amazing.
Evan,
yeah.
I understand you're trying to get Herald readers more involved in direct communications with the Herald. Is the Twitter account part of that?
Absolutely. You know, I've always been a proponent of answering every email I get. I think it's really important in this day and age for newspapers to engage readers however they want to be engaged, whether that's a written letter to the editor, which doesn't happen so much anymore, or an email or a phone call. But more and more, it's on Twitter and it's on Facebook. So I really think it's important for us to be there and engage with them, you know, instantaneously in real time. And I think that's one way to show readers that they're still important to us, whether they get their news online for free or whether they're still subscribers, which we love.
Well, you know, social media is changing constantly. It's hard to keep up with it. And you're so involved with it, Twitter, Facebook. What else? What other avenue are you looking at?
Well, there's Instagram, which is a big photo sharing service. It's an app that's really easy to use. It makes anyone's photos look great because there are all these different filters and focuses that you can use. But Miami.com, which I mentioned, our kind of sister entertainment-focused site, they have an Instagram account called at MiamiGrams. And I've joined that account, and I'm sorry to populate it with food porn, for lack of a better word. Whenever I'm out at a restaurant and I see something, or I'm eating something great, something looks pretty, whether I'm at home cooking something great and I like it, I'll take a picture of it and share it on there. So far, it's gotten some really good feedback from...
What was the address again?
Miami Grams, like Instagram.
Miami Grams. Well, yeah, I must admit that I do the same. I must admit that I take mostly pictures of desserts. What can I tell you?
Your favorite. Evan, are you a good cook?
I love to cook, yes. You know, cooking is kind of how I got my start in food and food writing. I started cooking for myself at home and in college kind of first, and then when I was off on my own out of college. And then through that, I started reading about food and food writing. I read Bill Buford's Heat, and he was a New Yorker magazine, a New Yorker writer who went off and cooked with Mario Batali, and he thought he would just do it for 3 months for an article, but ended up staying for a year and left his job and became a full-time chef. Kitchen Confidential, of course, from Anthony Bourdain, I love that. Making of a Chef, which was Michael Roman's story about how he, as a journalist, enrolled at the Culinary Institute of America, figuring, if I'm going to be writing about these chefs for the rest of my life, I should know what they do. So those three books really kind of turned me on to food writing. And from there, I was at the Herald, and Kathy Martin, my predecessor in this role, she let me write about food and kind of go hang out with chefs in Miami restaurants and report on the trends that were kind of happening out in the trenches. And that was a ton of fun. So I owe so much to her for kind of giving me that entree into food writing here at the Herald.
That's really interesting that you started by cooking in college, a guy cooking in college. It doesn't exactly fit the, you know, our picture of what happens to guys when they go off to college, you know?
Hey, guys can do ramen as well as anybody else.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
But what I want to wonder is, what did the kitchen like, or what did the hot plate look like?
Yeah, right.
They were cooking. I've seen some of those.
No, it was nothing glamorous, but I remember one of the first meals I made for my now wife. At the time we were dating, but it was just like a salmon kind of in a simmered tomato sauce with goat cheese, and it was great. And she still requests that to this day.
He must have a very smart wife. She lets him do the cooking. I think that's really great.
Yes, I agree.
We'll talk about restaurants and all. That's a popular column. People are always asking me, well, who reviews them? How do they review it? Explain a little bit how that works.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think the reviews are kind of one of the newsiest things we have in the paper, and that's one of the elements that isn't attached to recipes. This is our anonymous critic who goes out and visits restaurants a couple of times and gets a feel for the place and then gives it a rating, 1 to 4 stars, which carries a lot of weight. You know, in this day and age, we're talking about social media and online reviews. Kind of everyone can be a critic. And I think that makes the role of the traditional newspaper restaurant reviewer all the more important. So our main critic, Victoria Pesci Elliott, she's been doing it for a long time. She's fantastic. She really has her finger on the pulse of not just what is out there, but what's good and what is viable to be a flash in the pan and what might kind of be around for a long time to come. So we run her column every week, and we also run a review from Broward that we borrow from the Sun Sentinel. So we have every week a restaurant review from Miami-Dade and a restaurant review from Broward, and I think readers really enjoy reading those.
And it's nice to have a professional review, because there's a lot, you know, talk about social media, there's a lot out there that is not so professional.
Right, you know, a lot of them will rush in to be the first one to review a place. And look, there's a time and a place for that. People are hungry for what's open, what just opened yesterday, is it good, what do they serve? So we have that, too. We have a writer named Sarah List who writes for Miami.com, and she does something called First Look, and she tries to get into restaurants in their first few days of opening and doesn't write a review but just says, hey, here's the decor, here's the atmosphere, here's the menu, here are the price points.
Great.
And then, you know, Victoria waits at least 6 weeks before a restaurant is open to get its feet on the ground running and before she goes in to do her reviews. And she tries to mix up the days that she's there. She'll go on a busy weekend night maybe for dinner, and then she'll go on a slower weekday lunch just to get a feel for different times of service and who might
right.
be in the kitchen and on the floor.
Okay. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Evan Benn. He's the new Miami Herald food editor. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with the new Miami Herald food editor, Evan Benn. He's been telling us his plans for the food section, and we've been asking you what you'd like to see in the Miami Herald food section. Well, just to mention that Tuesday was Earth Day, as we all know, and continuing with National Green Week, Slow Food Miami will hold its third annual Snail of Approval tasting party. Well, that sounds good.
I don't think
they're serving snails.
Yeah.
it will be at the Raleigh Hotel tomorrow night. That's Friday. And you're going to be able to savor Miami's farm-to-table, the best food, the wine, the cocktails. And it's a good benefit because it benefits the Miami Edible Gardens Program, helping with school gardens in Miami-Dade County. And for tickets, you can go to brownpapertickets.com or just contact the Raleigh Hotel. All right, so it's dinner in minutes time.
Of course.
Now, Today's dinner, it's a nutty baked shrimp with Roman spinach and orzo. And Parmesan cheese and walnuts coat these juicy plump shrimp. And it's just a 15-minute meal. And it won't break your calorie bank either. Place the shrimp in a shallow baking dish and toss with some breadcrumbs. Drizzle with some olive oil. Pour a little wine in. Then sprinkle the Parmesan cheese and some crushed walnuts on top. Just bake it 10 minutes. Maybe under the broiler for a minute to brown the top. And that's it. And while that bakes, you can boil up some orzo. Now that's the small rice-shaped pasta. And just before the orzo is ready, you add some spinach to the water and it just sort of wilts in the water. Drain it and bring it back to the pan with some olive oil and raisins, salt and pepper. And that's your 15-minute meal. And if you'd like another dinner in minutes, try the Greek gyro sandwich with tzatziki sauce. Sorry, I'm drooling when I'm talking about this. It's in today's Miami Herald. And for the shrimp recipe, you can go to dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, I wanted to talk to Evan about beer, as I said. Now, Evan, I see you have a long background in beer writing. You were the beer columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and for Esquire.com. And you wrote for Beer Advocate. What am I missing? Do you have more credits?
You've got it. But, I wrote a book about beer when I was in St. Louis called Brew in the Loo, and I helped the St. Louis Post-Dispatch start a beer app, a smartphone app, so people could get my mini reviews and everything on at their fingertips. So that was fun. But I'm jealous of you being in Michigan because you have access to some great breweries up there.
Yeah, my brother-in-law is a major hops farmer up here. This is big, big deal stuff around here.
Wow.
But now I understand the book that you wrote in St. Louis was had a lot to do with Anheuser-Busch, which is a big company there. And although the kind of beers that they make tend to be flat in sales these days and craft beers are taking over, do you think Anheuser-Busch is worried or are they too big to fail?
Oh, they're definitely worried. And you can sense their worry in beers like Shock Top, which is Anheuser-Busch's Belgian wit beer. That's kind of their way to break into the craft market. Miller Coors, they're behind Blue Moon, which is another popular craft-like beer, but that's not actually a craft beer, which is, by definition, a craft brewery is much, much smaller than those breweries. They're independently owned, and they use traditional ingredients, whereas Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors, they tend to use things like corn and rice in their beers. Those are things called adjunct ingredients, which lighten the flavor, lighten the color. There's a big, big push for craft beer. And when I was in St. Louis, I had gotten there a year after InBev, which is this big Belgian corporation, bought out Anheuser-Busch, which had always been a local, homegrown St. Louis company. So all of a sudden, there was this sea change, and people were more willing to try new things that weren't Budweiser. So as a result, all of these craft breweries started popping up. And when I left last year, 2013, there were 22 craft breweries within a two-hour drive of downtown St. Louis.
Boy, that's impressive. So why do you think people are going from getting tired of regular beer and going to craft beer? Craft beer is usually more expensive, it usually has more alcohol, and it's more calories.
It's sort of the same things that we talk about on this show. It's people care more about their ingredients. They care more about who's making things they put in their bodies. And people are willing to pay sort of a premium for better products, better food, better beer, better wine. And that's a big part of why we're seeing this boom in craft beer. And it's just starting to reach South Florida, and we're seeing that with some great new breweries that are opening down here, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I guess we were behind the curve there for a while.
A little bit, but we're catching up. Miami has always been a cocktail culture and, chilled white wine and vodka, but craft beer is just as refreshing, just as versatile to pair with food. So it's really seeing its time to shine.
Well, here's my really crucial question: why do you think a lot of craft beers have such strange names? I've seen. I was looking up a list of them: Sick Duck, Homo Erectus, Seriously Bad Elf, Tactical Nuclear Penguin, and a whole lot that I can't say on NPR.
I was
going to
say, this is NPR,
yeah,
so watch it,
Fred. Getting
pretty
close there, Fred.
Well, a lot of brewers try to stand out by making a pun. There are a lot of hops puns, but there are only so many out there. So sometimes a lot of things, breweries have been creating this beers with the same names or beers that are close to the same names, and there have been a lot of trademark disputes and lawsuits actually in recent years between not just big breweries and craft breweries, but also among the little guys. That's something I actually covered recently for Beer Advocate, and I think it's an interesting story.
Do you think there can be such a thing as a beer snob?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny, when I did a story for our business section at the Herald on St. Patrick's Day on John Martin's Irish Pub, and I was talking to those guys, John Clark and Martin Lynch, the owners, about the craft beer movement and if they've really changed their beer selection as a result. And John, the owner, said, you know, craft beer is for people who like to sit there and think of, and talk about their beer. We like to serve beer that people like to drink.
Of course.
Listen, I guess he's making his point, yeah. Well, now, yeah. What about you? Are you a beer purist who says it should be made only from wheat and hops and water, or do you appreciate novelty beers with honey and peanut butter and chocolate in them?
Look, I'll try anything once, and I will not snub my nose if someone offers me a cold Budweiser on a hot
He's a true beer person. Fred, before we go, someone's been waiting to ask Evan a question.
Okay.
Hello, Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I had a question for
Evan?
Mr. Ben.
Yes.
I was curious. Congratulations on your new food editing job, but I wanted to know where you see the dining scene in Miami with respect to restaurants that are opening and closing over the next 12 months and over the next 5 years.
We only have about a minute left, but go ahead, Evan, see if you can answer him.
Well, that's a good question. Of course, it's hard to predict the future, but I do think I think Miami is really embracing the sort of local ingredient-driven food that Michael Schwartz really brought here with his Michael's Genuine Food and Drink in 2007. I know it's 7 years later, but I really think that's catching on in a major way. I think you can't open a restaurant in Miami now without having a well-sourced ingredient list with purveyors. You can't open a restaurant in Miami without having a craft beer list. So I think people are really caring about the hospitality and that side of dining. I think we'll see that continue.
Great.
Okay.
Nice to you. Well, it's really been a very, very interesting week. And Evan, Ben, once more, congratulations on becoming the Miami Herald food editor.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
And good luck in your new post. Fred Tasker, great advice and questions, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie Berman,
yes.
Great to be with you.
Great
we hope
to be
that
with you.
Joe will be able to come back next week.
I hope so, too.
Yes, okay.
Yes. And thank you, Evan, and thank you, Fred.
Right. And next week, we're going to be talking with Dwayne Wade's personal chef.
Oh.
Right. His Richard Ingram, about what the heat star eats to keep in shape and how we can do the same. We'll see.
With fewer calories.
Well, we'll
than
see.
The heat
well,
star.
We don't quite work it off in the same way.
And not quite.
Yes. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thank you for joining us today. That is our Topical Currents Thursday edition. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. Our online producer is Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and links to today's show. And more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow at this time, please join Ed Bell for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. On Monday's Topical Currents, we'll explore the legacy of the murder case of Kitty Genovese on the 50th anniversary of the crime. Award-winning author Kevin Cook tackles the issues surrounding the complicated case. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great Thursday, a great weekend. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.